Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of today's arguments before the Supreme Court on the overturning of California's Proposition 8 by Judge Vaughn Walker of the Ninth Circuit Court in San Francisco. Elizabeth Wydra, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, who was in the court today, joins us to discuss what can be interpreted from the blizzard of questions by the Supreme Court justices that might indicate that gay marriage could soon be legalized. Then we will speak with Deborah Brodigam, a professor and director of the International Development Program at Johns Hopkins University and author of The Dragon's Gift, The Real Story of China in Africa. We will discuss the new Chinese leader's visit to Africa and the BRICS, that's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa summit he is attending in South Africa. And we will also examine the extent to which Africa's honeymoon with China is over. Then finally, we will speak with the organizer of a recent conference in Paris where the Syrian opposition and representatives of the Kurdish minority met with senior American and French officials to design power-sharing arrangements in a post-Assad Syria. David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University, joins us to discuss what is being done to close the gap between the political representatives of the Syrian opposition and the various factions of fighters in the field who are now starting to shoot at each other. Joining us now is Elizabeth Wydra, who's chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution support progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Wydra.
Thank you, Ian. It's great to be with you.
And you're in the court today, and I heard quite a bit of it today on the radio, and there was certainly a blizzard of questions. It sort of reminded me of Chris Matthews, where he never lets these guests finish what they're saying. They sort of seamlessly cut each other off. Now, is that how it's always done, or was it particularly intense today?
You know, it is frequently like that with this court. They are very active questioners. And, you know, in some cases, actually, Chief Justice Roberts, as sort of, you know, the supervisor of the group, will have to negotiate and say, you know, actually, can you respond to Justice Sotomayor, you know, something like that. So they were extremely active today, which is, I think, a reflection, you know, obviously the fact that they are very active questioners, but also of the importance of the case. And I think particularly today, a reflection of the fact that I don't think that the justices even know which way they're going to come out on this, which is fairly unusual in a big case like this.
Well, Justice Anthony Kennedy is considered the swing vote, and people think he may well be sympathetic to the idea of overturning the ban on gay marriage. He's said that we're in the courts in entering uncharted waters. But my understanding is that the sort of 900-pound gorilla in this is whether or not it's the issue of standing is going to be invoked, and if so, would you mind explaining to our audience, Elizabeth, what that means? And I take it that if that were to happen, then Judge Vaughn Walker's ruling would stand, and Prop 8, the ban on Prop 8 would stand.
Yes. So standing in the federal law refers to basically the legal right that someone has to appear before a court. And in the Prop 8 case, what happened is that the couples who wanted to marry and were challenging the constitutionality of Prop 8 filed a lawsuit. And the Attorney General and Governor of California said, we agree with you that this law is unconstitutional, and so we're not going to defend it in court. And so the official proponents, the folks who got it on the ballot in the first place, stepped in and said, we will represent the interests of Proposition 8 and try to defend it in court. And so the district court, Judge Walker's ruling, which declared Proposition 8 unconstitutional, is a proper exercise of federal court power, because the people who were coming into court and claiming a legal injury were the couples who want to get married and clearly under federal law have a right to bring that claim in court. But when the case was appealed by the supporters of Prop 8 to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, that's when the question of standing, and again, when the supporters of Prop 8 lost in the Ninth Circuit and then appealed to the Supreme Court, that's where the question of whether or not they have standing really comes into play. And so if the Supreme Court finds that the official proponents of Prop 8 do not have the legal right to defend it in court, then that means that the Supreme Court wouldn't issue any ruling, and that means that they would vacate the Ninth Circuit's ruling. But importantly, it means that the district court's ruling, Judge Walker's ruling, which declared Prop 8 unconstitutional, that ruling would still stand. And so I think that would be, while not sort of the categorical victory that supporters of marriage equality would like from the Supreme Court, it would nonetheless still be a significant win for couples in California who want to get married and the families of the nearly 40,000 children in California whose families right now are branded as second class by this system in the state where they are told that their families, their parents, are not good enough for the institution of marriage. And so that would be a significant win to have that system struck down.
And do you think, Elizabeth Wider, that that's the most likely outcome? I mean, we're not going to hear until June, but everybody's speculating, so why don't you?
Well, it's very interesting because one thing that was clear after argument today is that if the justices can avoid issuing a ruling on the merits, they would really like to do that. What is less clear is how exactly they go about it, because this standing issue that we talked about certainly was discussed a lot, but some of the justices, like Justice Kennedy, who's a very important vote on this court, he didn't really seem to buy that argument, but all of the justices seemed to want to sort of let the issue percolate amongst the states and allow further public debate on it. You know, despite the fact that, look, you know, the way the Constitution works in our country is that we don't put our most fundamental rights up to a vote. It is the court's obligation to apply the Constitution, and in this case, apply the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, and say, look, it doesn't get to be decided by the people of a state whether or not the fundamental right to marry is afforded equally to all. The Constitution requires that same-sex couples and opposite-sex couples have the same right to marry the person that they love.
Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Wider, who is the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the Federal Court of Appeals and was in the Supreme Court today when the justices were questioning witnesses for and against overturning Prop 8. And by extension, at least indicating how maybe future rulings may take place on overturning a ban on gay marriage. Tell me about who this lawyer, Charles Cooper, is. He was representing opponents of gay marriage. He got, I thought, fairly effectively grilled by Justice Elena Kagan and Stephen Breyer when he insisted that marriage is about promoting procreation as primary reason for limiting the definition of marriage. And then they, of course, immediately said, well, wait a minute, infertile opposite-sex couples can marry, and even somebody at the age of 55 can marry. I think, Justice Kagan said, I can assure you that at the age of 55, you're not going to have any kids, you know.
Chuck Cooper defended vigorously the virility of older men by suggesting to Justice Kagan that, oh, yeah, it's not a problem for men over 55 to father children. But, you know, I think that one important thing that happened today is that these so-called rationales for excluding gay and lesbian couples from the institution of marriage just were shown to be absolutely foolish. You know, the idea that the whole point of marriage is to foster procreation, you know, doesn't in any way account for the fact that states allow couples who are infertile, who are elderly, or who simply don't want to have children to get married. And one really important exchange that I think happened today was Justice Kagan asked Mr. Cooper, the lawyer for the supporters of the ban on gay marriage, she asked him, what harm is it that occurs? How are opposite sex couples harmed by including gay and lesbian couples in the institution of marriage? And he could not give her a single instance of how heterosexual couples are harmed when gay couples are allowed to marry. And I think that that is a really telling concession that, you know, even let's say, even if you bought this somewhat outlandish idea that the state has an interest in fostering heterosexual marriage because they want responsible procreation, it doesn't harm that interest in any way to allow loving, committed gay and lesbian couples to also enjoy the freedom to marry. And so whatever happens, I think that that was a very important development this morning.
So I don't know whether you saw what was going on outside Elizabeth Wydra, but there were some jeering and shouting between the anti-gay marriage protesters and the pro-gay marriage protesters. And I thought what was interesting in many ways about Theodore Olson, of course, who argued today before the Supreme Court, back in the arguments over Prop 8 in San Francisco before Judge Vaughn Walker, Judge Walker warned Theodore Olson that he should consider not that he would lose this case, but he might win it before the Supreme Court. And he went on to talk about how our politics have been plagued for 40, 50 years by the politics of abortion, and implying that there could be a social backlash to a legalizing gay marriage. Do you buy that argument?
Well, I don't buy it in the first instance because I think there is such a strong momentum in support of marriage equality. I mean, you know, for the younger generation, it's simply not a big deal to have friends whose parents are gay, to know people who are gay or lesbian and are going to get married. And so I think it's really just at most a generational issue, and I think the momentum is going in that direction. But even more important is the fact that the Constitution applies regardless of public opinion. And when the Supreme Court in 1967 struck down laws that banned interracial marriages in Loving versus Virginia, the majority of the country supported prohibiting people of different races from marrying one another. And that didn't change the fact that these laws were unconstitutional and that they were impermissibly discriminatory on the basis of race. And so I think we're in, you know, an even stronger position in this case, in that you have a majority of Americans who support the legality of same-sex marriage and the plain words of the Constitution's guarantee of equal protection of the laws, which clearly applies to all Americans, black or white, gay or straight, man or woman. And so I think that, you know, it's something for the political folks to keep in mind, whether there's going to be a backlash, but it's not really the justices' jobs to balance that equation. Their job is to apply the Constitution.
So, Elizabeth Wydra, the polls, of course, indicate 60% of Americans think the federal government should recognize same-sex marriages. So how do you account for that change so quickly from Prop 8 here in California? Was that just a quirk that passed, or were the opponents – I remember seeing the ad campaign. The people who were against Prop 8, in other words, who for gay marriage, had the lamest commercials. So that could have been a factor. But what happened? Because they didn't even they were sort of afraid to broach the real issue. So I'm just in the last few minutes, I'm curious about what's happened to the country in the sense that you have suddenly now have a majority. in favor?
Well, I think it's very interesting, and it has been, as several of the justices pointed out today, it has been a rather rapid change in public opinion. And several of the justices were concerned that, well, we just don't know, what the implications of recognizing same-sex marriage might be. Justice Alito raised that in particular. He said, the recognition of marriage equality for gay and lesbian couples is something that's newer than the internet and cell phones. And, as I've said before, I don't think that's really relevant to the constitutional analysis, but I think it does speak to a change in society and culture where, as we saw with Chief Justice Roberts' cousin, who is lesbian and was at the argument this morning, and some of the other Republicans, prominent conservatives who have come out in favor of marriage equality, everyone has someone in their life who is gay or lesbian. And when you see these people whom you love and respect and think about why their love for their partner isn't going to be honored in the same way that yours might be, then I think you really start to think very hard about whether these sorts of laws are really consonant with American values.
Well, obviously, you can't legislate love, but I think you can agree that there's not enough love out there. And then there's not enough parents who love their children, and gay parents certainly appear to love their children, perhaps even more, because it's so difficult for them to go through that process. And I was interested in how much there was talk of and concern for the children of gay married couples or gay couples who want to be married, and how these children are discriminated against. Did that strike you as being interesting?
That was a big topic of discussion, and Justice Kennedy brought up very early in the questioning of Mr. Cooper, who was defending Prop 8. He said, what about the voices of the nearly 40,000 children in California who are raised by same-sex parents? Don't they have the right to have their families be treated equally with other people's families? And I thought it was really interesting when Mr. Cooper, in trying to give some sort of legitimate reason for why you would want to exclude gay and lesbian couples from the institution of marriage, kept talking about the interests of the children. And it was brought up in response to that that argument in California certainly can't hold any weight, because gay and lesbian couples are given the same right to adopt as opposite sex couples. And so if the state really believed that there was some negative consequence to children from being raised by same-sex couples, presumably they wouldn't have this policy. So it really just lays bare the idea that the only reason that these families, that these gay and lesbian couples are prohibited from marrying, is because the supporters of Proposition 8 wanted to say that their families and their relationships are inferior to opposite sex couples, and our Constitution simply does not allow for that.
Well, Elizabeth Wadrai, thank you so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Wadrai, who is the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals, and attended the Supreme Court's hearing today on overturning Prop 8 in California. So we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the BRICS meeting in South Africa and the visit by the new Chinese leader to Africa.
Ooh, love breaks the machine. Everything's half a dream. How can it be? Everything's born in shame. It's not just me. Particle wave duality.
Nenua, chinois.com. Yo poblano suma.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Deborah Bradigam, who is a professor and director of the International Development Program at Johns Hopkins University and a visiting professor at the University of Bergen in Norway. She is the author of The Dragon's Gift, The Real Story of China in Africa. Welcome to Background Briefing, Deborah Bradigam.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
And the meeting that's taking place, the fifth annual summit of the BRICS group, that's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, this is the first time that they've all met in Africa. And, of course, China's new leader there, Xi Jinping, is there as well. So what's your sense then, Deborah, since you wrote about this and questioned this sort of new Chinese charm offensive in Africa in The Dragon's Gift, The Real Story of China in Africa. You're saying now that the honeymoon is over, that now they are working on their relationship and it's not purely harmonious by any means. So explain further, if you will.
Well, I think in about 2006 was when people really started to focus on the Chinese in Africa, and there really was a honeymoon period. There was a huge meeting in Beijing, and you had 44 African heads of state showing up. People were amazed at this. This has never happened in London. It never happened in Paris, and it never happened in Washington, but it did happen in Beijing. So it was quite an astounding success for the Chinese invitations. And this launched a period of kind of rosiness in the relationship. But as with any marriage, there are rocky spots, and they have been going through quite a few rocky spots. I don't think this means that China's going to be leaving Africa, that things are going to break apart, but they're getting realistic now. And so Xi Jinping is talking about this. He's trying to address some of the complaints that African governments have and African citizens. So I think he's being surprisingly forthcoming for a Chinese leader to be this open that the relationship has its rough spots.
Well, of course, the trade now in between China and Africa is at $200 billion in 2012. So that's not insubstantial. And of course, the BRICS themselves, that's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, their economies represent about 23% of the world's landmass, 43% of the population, and 17% of global trade. And they are, in many ways, the fastest growing group, are they not, in amongst, well, there's only the U.S. and the EU left pretty much, right?
No, I think you're right there. And I think the fact that the BRICS summit is happening now, and that is happening in South Africa, is important. This is symbolic. You have a new world now. It's a new world order. You've got a world where Angola is making loans to Portugal. You've got a world in which the IMF is taking help from India to bail out Europe. And so having these five countries, South Africa is really a baby brick, but these five significant countries which represent the world's what we used to call the third world. They represent all those regions outside of Europe and outside of North America. And they're meeting together and they're discussing their shared interests. So it's really an interesting situation. That's why this is important. And that's why the fact this was Xi Jinping's first visit outside of China is also important.
Now, is he just following? I mean, wasn't it Hu Jintao, his predecessor, who was called the African in China because he had a real affection and interest in Africa?
I think Hu Jintao did have a special interest in Africa, but I think that's almost irrelevant. What we can see going back for the last few decades is that Chinese leaders, Chinese presidents and Chinese premiers have been going to Africa. I have a map in my book in which I document these trips. And they're going everywhere. In fact, one of the few countries they hadn't visited yet was the Republic of Congo. And that's one of the places that Xi Jinping is going to be going on this trip. But they've been regularly going to Africa. They've been showing Africa that it has China's respect and that China
that it matters for Chinese leaders. We're not giving Africa that same kind of message.
Well, indeed, we have some American hedge fund managers in the Congo buying up sovereign debt and squeezing, you know, this is the worst of kind of vulture capitalism. I don't know that you can make a case that that represents all of the Western involvement in Africa, but the historical record is not particularly good, is it?
Well, I think the historical record, if you want to go way back, of course, Africa's had a really unfortunate engagement with the West, slavery, colonialism, all of that. I think in current years, we have a mixture of areas in which we engage with Africa. I think our foreign aid program, which is from the United States, is actually quite generous, and it's pretty much focused on health. So we're doing a lot to keep Africans alive through that foreign aid program. A lot of it's going into malaria, HIV/AIDS. But what we're not doing is we're not treating African governments and African countries like real partners. We're basically saying, you have a lot of problems, we need to help you, we're here to save you. But we're not saying, we're really here to engage with you as equals, and let's see what kind of business we can do together. That's the message the Chinese bring, and it's really quite welcome.
And in terms of the political instability in Africa, we're just witnessing in the Central African Republic a group of military thugs taking over, looting everything, even the hospitals they're looting. I understand the Chinese are a bit gun-shy because they suffered a lot of losses. There are 40,000 Chinese workers working on an $18 billion project in Libya when the civil war took place, and they didn't see that coming, and they had to get out of Libya. There, I assume that the situation, the enormous investments that China's made in the oil in southern Sudan, which has to be piped out through northern Sudan, and they're basically, you know, almost going to war with each other on a daily basis. That has not necessarily proven to be a good investment. And then there was a major reversal in Myanmar, Burma, where the Chinese were trying to, I think, build this huge dam that the Burmese suddenly realized it was going to benefit China and not them. So give me a sense of the, you know, the successes and reversals, if you will, of China's involvement in Africa and by extension in Burma.
I think you've laid out some of the deeper areas of problems that the Chinese have had. And I think when you look at Libya, this has been a real wake-up call for the Chinese. As you said, they had $18 billion worth of business there. And this business was actually not oil or investment, but it was construction business. And you did have Chinese workers there. 34,000 had to be rescued. There were actually even more than that. At the end of 2010, according to official statistics, there were 46,000 Chinese working in Libya. That was about a quarter of all the Chinese working in Africa were in that one country. So this was very big business for them, and they were bitterly hit by that. And it caused them really to question why they didn't know beforehand how unstable Libya was. But I think nobody really had an idea of the Arab Spring. It surprised everyone. But in places like Burma, I think it's actually a very healthy move. What was going on there was a particular project that was very unpopular with the local people. And so with the new government coming into Burma, they're listening more to their population. It's the kind of problem that we call NIMBY, not in my backyard. People that didn't want hydropower project and a dam flooding their area, and they didn't like the way that the Chinese companies were not paying very much attention to social concerns in the area. They basically were just coming in and building the project, and it was going to be exporting electricity to China. So these kinds of things, really what we're talking about is globalization and the expansion of capitalism. And so this comes about as a problem full of conflict. It's been full of conflict when the West went out, and it's still full of conflict because you've got capital. You've got capital, labor kinds of conflict, so conflicts between employers and employees. Right. And you've got problems for investors and people who are in the areas where they want to invest. So these kinds of the expansion of capitalism, the expansion of investment, the expansion of the market is not a smooth process. And the Chinese are hitting these kinds of difficulties right now, just the kinds that we have done in the past. So it's new for them. I think they'll be learning from it, but there's no question but that it's hit them hard.
And Deborah Brannigan, again, professor and director of the International Development Program at Johns Hopkins University and the author of The Dragon's Gift, The Real Story of China in Africa. What about reports we've heard of Chinese foremen and overlords, if you will, at these mines and other investments they've made, treating the African workers poorly? And there was a case in Zambia where some Zambian miners struck and the Chinese just opened fire on them with shotguns. So how isolated is that?
It's actually quite isolated. The one mine that we keep hearing about was just recently closed by the Zambian government because it had violated safety standards and labor regulations over and over again for years. And so the new government came in and they closed it down, quite rightly. This was a private Chinese mine, really the most egregious form of foreign investment, very irresponsible, and very bad labor relations. But to explain a little bit about what happened in that mine, when the managers came out with the shotgun, there were two cases in which Chinese managers at that mine were actually killed by workers. So the labor relations had gotten so bad that the workers were killing the managers and the managers were shooting at the workers. Fortunately, none of them died. But this was a really bad situation. However, it's the one story we hear about over and over again, and I don't think it's typical.
And in Sudan, do you think the Chinese will recoup their investment there?
You know, one of the surprising things has been how smoothly they moved into the relationship with South Sudan. You would think that South Sudan, after fighting with North Sudan and having China be very firmly in North Sudan's court, that they would find it much more challenging to have any kind of relationship with South Sudan. But Sudan is what gave birth to shuttle diplomacy in China. So they're shuttle diplomats for African affairs were assigned to work on the Sudan problem. They've also been going to Zimbabwe. They've gone to some other hot spots, and they've been kept quite busy. So this is a new thing for China to have shuttle diplomacy, and I think we'll be seeing more of this in the future.
And Deborah Brannigan, just back to the BRICS conference underway now in South Africa, BRICS being Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And this is the first time that the fifth meeting of BRICS and the first time they've met in Africa. And, of course, the Chinese new Chinese leader, Xi Jinping, is there. One of the things that they're talking about is a foundation of a BRICS bank. Apparently, South Africa wants the bank in South Africa and Russia wants the bank in Russia. I'm not sure that there's a lot of rule of law and stability in the banking sector in Russia. So how's that going to work out, do you think?
I think it's going to be a while before we see the BRICS bank actually taking off, because the only country out of this group of five that really has money is China. And I'm not sure that China wants to see its money sitting in Russia, in a BRICS bank there. And the Chinese already have some very good banks that are financing their push into globalization. They've got the China Development Bank, and they've got the China Exim Bank, and these are both huge. So the BRICS bank would be symbolic. I know they're discussing it. I don't see it actually happening anytime soon.
So what do you see happening with BRICS then? I mean, is this a photo op or is there some real substance going on in South Africa?
I think it's a photo op in terms of the five countries there and that opportunity. But I do think that what is happening is that the shift in power away from the traditional players, Europe, the United States, that's very real. And whether it's going to go directly to the BRICS or whether it's going to go directly to the BRICS or whether it's going to go to other actors that are also rising? I think these are the questions. China's definitely going to be a player there. I don't see Russia. Russia's not a big brick. South Africa is kind of a small player there. But power influence is shifting to where the population centers are. And that's a long overdue change. I think we should welcome it, even though it's frightening for us.
Well, the big difference between China and the U.S., at least as I see it, is that China has had its charm offensive through soft power. And we have, in the last few decades, wasted so much of our treasure and our good name on hard power in these useless wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, I think there's certainly something to be said about that. When you think about the billions and billions that we've been spending on war and the billions and billions that China's been spending building infrastructure, you know, if I was a foreign partner, I could see which one might look a little bit more enticing as someone I wanted to engage with. And I think a lot of countries are thinking a little bit like that. However, you know, when it comes down to it, people around the world still look at the United States, they look at America, and they say, that's what we find really attractive in terms of a model. That's where we would like to move if we had the opportunity. And they're not saying that about China.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Deborah. I know you're at an airport there, and it's a little been distracting for you, but I appreciate your time.
Well, it was great to talk with you, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Deborah Brodigam, who's a professor and director of the International Development Program at Johns Hopkins University and a visiting professor at the University of Bergen in Norway. She's the author of The Dragon's Gift, The Real Story of China in Africa. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the organizer of a conference in Paris recently where the Syrian opposition and representatives of the Kurdish minority met with senior American and French officials to come up with a power-sharing arrangement when Assad falls. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq, Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's also on the adjunct faculty at Harvard's Humanitarian Initiative and has worked as a senior advisor to the United Nations Secretariat and as a foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the United States Department of State. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you, Ian.
And I take it that you organized a conference recently in Paris that essentially brought together the Kurdish Institute of Paris and your institute at Columbia University and members of the Syrian opposition to dialogue on power sharing in Syria after the fall of Assad. There are reports already, David Phillips, of fighting between the rebel Farouk brigades, which are among the most effective of the secular organizations, where one of the leaders, Abu Azam, was shot by the Islamist al-Nusra people. And apparently there's more and more of these incidents. So already you have, albeit at a smaller scale, you have the Syrian opposition shooting at each other. So give us a sense of the disconnect, which appears to be between the people in the field and the people who meet. Is there a real disconnect there between the political spokespersons and the actual operational people?
Our meeting in Paris involved minority groups, and the participants were largely Kurds from Syria. Of the 30 or so who gathered, more than half came from the Qamishli area within Syria. And it was really the first time that the Kurds from within Syria had gotten together and had a dialogue with diaspora Kurds. I think that the way to avoid this kind of violent conflict between different constituencies in the opposition is to get them talking to each other about what kinds of power-sharing arrangements they're going to want to have in place after Assad. If there's a political dialogue going on, they're less likely to use violence to settle their differences.
Well, of course, at the Arab League summit underway in Doha, the Syrian opposition was seated as the official representatives of Syria, which, of course, has angered the Assad regime. And the rebel leader who quit the other day, Mr. Hatib, has joined with the National Coalition's Vice Presidents George Sabra and Suhir Atassi and the recently elected Prime Minister Hassan Hito. So to that extent, there seems to be some, at least, a political group. What do the Kurds have to do with this group that's seated in Doha at the Arab League summit in the name of Syria?
There are two important points here. The first is that you have to rely on partners on the ground in country. The mistake that we made in Iraq was listening to the diaspora and investing too much expectation in them. So if there's going to be any kind of a fluid regime change after Assad, it's going to be driven by the in-country actors, and we have to reach out to them, get to know them, and help them in dialogue with each other. So that's an important point. The other is the role of the Kurds. About 15% of Syria's population is Kurdish. They have really yet to be counted in the revolution. Over the years, they've been afflicted by the Assad regime. They've had their identity and their rights denied. They're also very deeply worried about Islamists and Sunni Arabs that are leading the revolution. So they've been sitting on the fence, waiting to see which way the wind is going to blow. They know that there's going to be a regime change, so they're starting to have a political dialogue with each other. They're also beginning to reach out to other members of the Syrian National Council so they can forge coalitions. Our role is to be helpful and to try to create an environment where they can focus on technical, legal, and constitutional issues about how they'll govern themselves.
Again, I'm speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq, Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's also on the adjunct faculty at Harvard's Humanitarian Initiative, and he's worked as a senior advisor to the United Nations Secretariat and as a foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the United States Department of State. So the takeaway from President Obama's recent trip to Israel and Jordan and the West Bank was largely that he arranged a phone call that brought together or brought back together the Prime Minister of Israel and the Prime Minister of Turkey. Of course, there's been a bitter estrangement between those two countries, and I don't know the extent to which they're healed, but it would indicate to me that something's going on the ground there. In fact, Netanyahu said it has a lot to do with Syria. So what's your understanding of what the Turks and the Israelis are trying to get together over vis-a-vis Syria?
Nobody wants chemical weapons to fall into the hands of terrorist organizations. I suspect that the reason why Prime Minister Erdogan and Prime Minister Netanyahu decided to have their phone conversation now is because they both share a national interest. Israel doesn't want Syria's WMD ending up with Hezbollah, its avowed enemy with whom it has recently waged a war and which is a foreign terrorist organization. And likewise, Turkey doesn't want the WMD ending up in the hands of the PKK, with whom it has fought a civil war over the past four decades. So Israel and Turkey have come together out of a common concern that Syria risks imploding. And when it falls apart, its chemical weapons are going to fall into the wrong hands.
So what is the role then of the PKK leader, Öcalan, who's in custody, been in custody for some time, calling for a ceasefire between the PKK and the Turkish military?
It's rather remarkable that Abdullah Öcalan, who's been in custody for more than a decade, is still running the PKK from his cell in Imrali prison. Through his lawyers, he issues instructions, and he is still the head honcho behind the organization. Turkey's military intelligence has been meeting discreetly with Öcalan to talk about a ceasefire and the terms for a negotiation around a comprehensive peace going forward. The fact that Öcalan has called for the PKK to withdraw its fighters from Turkish territory and that Prime Minister Erdogan has renewed his commitment to protecting and promoting the identity of Kurds in Turkey is a very good step. But it's part of a process, and there have been ceasefires before. Ultimately, if there's going to be a peace agreement between the PKK and Turkey, it's going to have to go beyond democracy and development. It's going to have to address the really thorny issues of how do you create an amnesty for these hardened PKK fighters, and what kind of accountability is going to exist, both for members of the security services in Turkey who have committed crimes, but also for the PKK, which itself is victim, has victimized Turks over these years.
So back to the central question, David Phillips, about the connection or the disconnection between the Free Syrian Army and the various factions fighting to topple the Assad dictatorship and the political leadership, the heads of which are seated at the Arab summit in Doha representing Syria. And if you have, as I mentioned at the outset, already incidents of where a rebel commander of a secular group, the Farouk Brigades, Abu Azam, was shot by the Islamist group al-Nusra, and apparently there have been a number of showdowns between the Islamists and the more secular rebels, that's certainly not a harbinger for things to come. On the other hand, one hears that shipments of arms from Qatar are increasing, and also that the CIA is getting more and more active in training and selecting groups with whom they feel comfortable giving weapons to. So what's happening on the ground? Because for the longest time, the Iranians have had their act together, and they've been doubling down, been absolutely unflinching in their support for Assad. But the West has clearly vacillated. Has that changed?
My most recent book, which is entitled Liberating Kosovo, is a study of interventions over the past decade. And there's one salient lesson that emerges from all these experiences. Reaching the tipping point and toppling a regime is an event that occurs on a single day, but building an effective state and designing effective governance is a process that takes a much longer period of time and a sustained commitment from the U.S. and the international community. And that never works unless you have a reliable and credible local partner who's trusted by constituents on the ground. So there are two parts to your question, Ian. One is the military assistance that's going to the Free Syrian Army, and the other is what comes after Assad in the event that the Free Syrian Army succeeds. Part of the reason why we've been reluctant to arm the Free Syrian Army is because we don't know very much about them, and there isn't a cohesive leadership structure in place to replace Assad when he goes. That's why having a political dialogue about governance is just as important during this stage of a conflict as arming rebel groups. You can topple the regime in a day, but you can't establish effective governance unless you're in it for the long haul.
So who's working on that portfolio, if that's the right way to describe it? Who's working on forging a real connection between the political leadership that's representing Syria now at Doha and the fighters? Because Assad's just retook an important neighborhood in Homs from the rebels. So it's certainly premature to write off Assad's military. So how's that achieved then?
Ultimately, it has to be achieved by Syrians themselves. Outsiders can play a catalytic role, but Syrians have to get together, and they've got to figure out how they're going to interact in the future. The kinds of meetings that occur internationally create a safe space for them to start talking about how they're going to rule the country if and when they come to power. At our meeting in Paris, we had the special envoy from the United States, the special envoy of France, of Norway. We had President Hollande's senior foreign policy advisor. So there are some countries that are really leaning forward on this, working on a political solution. There are other countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar that are much more focused on providing military support to the Free Syrian Army. What's important is to be able to map who the players are, know who you're dealing with, and try to develop a relationship with them and help them develop a relationship with one another. Otherwise, there's bound to be spoilers and infighting, and then the conflict risks escalating, and you might actually find yourself with a worse problem in the future than exists now. And what exists now is pretty horrible.
Well, apparently one of the motives behind Ahmed Moaz al-Hatib, the rebel leader who quit and now has rejoined the opposition and is seated representing Syria at the Arab summit in Doha, he was upset about a lot of things, but he was also upset about the role of Saudi Arabia and Qatar in supplying arms to the Salafists. So is there a problem here about which of the sponsors of the Syrian opposition, what outcomes they want? Is there a divide between what the U.S. and France, for example, and Turkey want and what Saudi Arabia and Qatar want? Do they want regimes like they have, particularly the Saudis, a theocratic regime, an Islamic regime, or is that where the fundamental problem lies?
And the fundamental problem lies with Assad, who's a butcher and a war criminal. Getting these groups together is difficult in and of itself, especially because they are proxies for regional powers. I mean, what's missing in the diplomacy is a contact group that should be based in Turkey and brings different countries together so they can have a coherent strategy about how they're going to support the rebels and how they're going to work with the political side of the opposition to stand up some kind of a credible alternative. It's not rocket science. Ultimately, Syria should be democratic, pluralistic, and federal. There should be decentralization that pushes power from Damascus to the region so that the minorities, including the Kurds, have their interests upheld. Getting from here to there is extremely difficult when a population is under duress. And with almost 100,000 people killed and several million displaced, there's been an enormous duress for the people of Syria. And it is true, al-Khatib is correct, that the international community has not done enough to support them diplomatically, in humanitarian terms. Since he's seeking military assistance, you know, his view is they require more military assistance and training. I'm sure that the U.S. can provide some logistical support, some equipment, some hard-shell vehicles, some night vision goggles, some transportation infrastructure that would be of enormous use. So there's a big malaise among the opposition because they're getting killed every day. You know, we're talking a good game, but we're not delivering on it.
Well, at the conference in Paris that you organized, David Phillips, with the Kurdish groups and the Syrian opposition, you mentioned some of the very distinguished people that spoke there, including Robert Ford, the U.S. ambassador to Syria, who I imagine is in pretty close contact with the new Secretary of State, John Kerry, isn't he? So when you suggest that what's needed is a contact group so that the foreign sponsors of the opposition in Syria can coordinate, has that been suggested to Kerry?
So you'll have to invite Ambassador Ford on your program and ask him.
Right, but that's just assumption on my part.
He's a skillful diplomat. He's working this problem 24/7. Informally, there's a lot of international coordination. But a contact group creates an institution, as it did in Kosovo, to marginalize those countries that are acting as spoilers. I mean, just as Russia tried to block NATO and U.S.-led action in Kosovo, Russia is blocking international efforts here in Syria. So one way to marginalize the Russians is to create an institution that gives greater voice to other stakeholders. So, you know, there are ways of solving these problems. I'm sure the U.S. is working all those strategies very hard, but clearly, you know, we haven't done enough to stop the bloodshed. When we get to a tipping point, we better be ready to work with a broad coalition of Syrians, because it's going to be chaotic no matter what.
Well, just in closing, David Phillips, what kind of timeline are we talking about here? Does anybody have any idea? Because the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has on a number of occasions indicated that Assad was about to fall, and that clearly has not happened. So, as we mentioned earlier, it does seem that there's an uptick in the supplying of arms to the Syrian rebels, but there's also Iran is unflinching in its support of the Assads, and John Kerry got nowhere with the Iraqis trying to convince them they shouldn't allow the overflight of all this equipment that's going into Syria. So what's your sense of a timeline here, given that there have been some premature statements about the fall of Assad?
So the Syrian armed forces are extremely capable. They are receiving from Iran resupplies on a daily basis. Those transport planes are flying through Iraqi airspace, and even though we've asked Iraq to crack down, they refuse to do so. So this war could be a long grind that can go on for a long period of time. But at the same token, Ian, you can't really foresee a tipping point. Now, for all the intelligence that you gather and the analysis that people do, you can get to that moment when the regime falls very quickly if some of the key regime allies, particularly in the military, feel that their interest is better served by switching sides. So we could be looking at a war in Syria over the next year or more, or we could open the paper tomorrow and see that there's a tipping point and a dramatic change. It's going to require concerted diplomatic activity led by the U.S. to prepare for either of those eventualities. That's why the kind of meeting we had in Paris, looking at constitutional arrangements for the next phase, are such an important part of planning for the future.
Well, David Phillips, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I mean, speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's also on the adjunct faculty at Harvard's Humanitarian Initiative and was a senior advisor to the United Nations Secretariat and a foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the United States Department of State. His latest book is Liberating Kosovo. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.